Hello, dearest listeners. Taylor here. I want to give a ridiculous amount of love to our sponsors. The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication. It's the best, with both serious scholarship and articles that play the game. The BSJ is essential reading for anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and a world where it's always 1895. The Scintillation of Scions is an annual symposium of fans of Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle that is sponsored by Watson's Tin Box in Maryland, USA. Find out more about The Scintillation at www.scintillation.org. Wessex Press and their imprint Gasogene Books is the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. There also are publishers. The Baker Street Babes Essay Collection, The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, Essays on Sherlockiana by Online Fandom, will be released on January 18th online at wessexpress.com and at the Baker Street Irregulars Weekend in New York. Curly will also be signing copies in the Merchant's Room on the day of the release. The Merchant's Room is located in the Vanderbilt Suite of the Roosevelt Hotel, 45 East 45th Street in New York City. The book runs an impressive 280 pages and will be $24.95.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland Yard, they send you home, you feel like you're losing. You crying, won't you two one mine?
Well, welcome to Baker Street Babes episode number 49, where we're discussing the new Sherlock season, Empty Hearst, that we've only been waiting for a couple of years. Today on the podcast we have Lindsay Fay, Amy Thomas, Turk, and Christina.
Hello.
And me, Taylor. And hopefully Catherine will be joining us.
Yes. Right, so the Empty Hearst went out yesterday, and regardless of what time you are actually listening to this, just know it came out on January the 1st, 2014 at 9 p.m. to 9.2 million viewers, and that's just watching
legal
it.
Viewers.
Well, that's just the TV. They haven't done iPlayer or anything else yet, but it's pretty darn high. It's the highest audience Sherlock has ever had, which is just shows that it's still incredibly popular, incredibly anticipated. My favorite thing is that the first 5 minutes had 9.7 and then it dropped to 9.2. So all the people who thought the first fake theory was the actual theory are walking around feeling like prized idiots, and I love that.
That's brilliant.
That is good.
But I'm still curious to know what the figures look like for EastEnders.
Before
all of us watched the last 5 minutes of EastEnders in anticipation.
It was the first EastEnders I've ever seen in my life.
Hopefully
all
it will be the last. So, we're just going to go straight through this episode, talk about things along the way. We have tons of questions from followers, so we'll work those in as we can. And yeah, so, Darren Brown... kissing, shattering things, bungee cords.
I love Darren Brown.
I stand by
I would have been very happy if that was what actually happened. That was lovely. I love him.
I stand by my assertion that that whole first part of this was just an Old Spice commercial.
It was such an Old Spice commercial.
It would have been
you
only
have
better
never
if Sherlock had ended up on a horse.
Every crack conspiracy theory, you know, moment at once, like they, you know, with the bungee cord, and you're like, really? And then with the swooping kiss, it was like, wow, this is really, you're just diving right in there. We're going full throttle from second one.
Yeah. It was really funny because at the BFI screening, it started, and then, so everyone's like laughing and cheering, and then you, because at first they're dragging Moriarty away with the mask, and I hear a few people going, yes, I knew it, and then it slowly just sort of dissolves into you're like, what? Like, the audience going, oh, what? Huh? And, like, it was funny, because Darren Brown was sitting right in front of me and Catherine, and we're just kind of going, oh, what's going on?
Well, there's two things I want to say, I just remembered. The first is that Sherlock rarely breaks the fourth wall for me, but I did have the thought, oh my word, Benedict and Louise filmed this and I'm so amused right now. But the second thing I wanted to say is, can anybody pinpoint the moment that you went, wait, what? Like, was it from the beginning, or did you have a moment where you were like, okay, I can go with this, and then all of a sudden you're like, no. I think it was kind of all too fast, but I just wondered.
Well, that was literally the only spoiler I had in advance, was that that was Anderson's theory and it wasn't real. So I was all right. I knew that wasn't actually happening.
You were on it. I felt like watching it, it didn't unfold the way I knew it was going to, you know, like it didn't take the time the way that you just said, Amy. It didn't take the amount of time that you knew it was going to need to. And then the bungee jump and you're just like, what? This is ridiculous. And also, it wasn't a spoiler in any way, but the mini episode, the Christmas episode, which we haven't mentioned yet, but which was also really wonderful, mm-hmm. I thought, sort of brings up the fact that Anderson is yes. the Sherlock fandom, you know, and that there are conspiracy theories and that people are talking about this. So I think that sort of maybe dovetailed in my imagination into what it actually was.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, like, it had me for maybe about the first few seconds, and then as soon as I saw the bungee cord, I'm like, wait, we would have seen that.
The bungee cord. I was like, oh my word.
I don't care how hard you hypnotize John Watson, his mind is too strong. Not see a bungee cord. Like, you could hypnotize the shit out of him, and he'd still see a bungee cord, I tell you what.
Yeah. I will admit that I squealed at the kiss, though. I had
proper
feelings.
Every Sherlolly fan in the world was with you. I could hear the screams.
It's a good kiss, hair ruffle and everything. It's good. Good.
Her tweets were hysterical.
Yes.
Yes.
Four takes. It was really difficult to get right.
If I were her, I'd have kept bodging it up, you know?
Right.
Like, oh, she could have got more than four takes out of it.
Yeah. So after we get faked out, there's John and Mary Morstan at the grave just to sort of punch you in the feelings. And then we switch to Sherlock running around in a horrible wig in Serbia. But I like the fact that they showed a bit of Sherlock in the hiatus.
And they used that Christ imagery. Did you see that? Like, where he has... where he died for people and where he is stripped and, like, you know, like with the arms out and the being tormented. It was Sherlock's 3 days in hell, you know, like the tropes were everywhere.
Oh, see, I didn't pick him. I was just going, hey, look, bondage.
No, it was a total hero's descent to the underworld and Jesus coming back thing. Like it was like, because when the hero sacrifices himself, he's, you know, then tormented and goes to hell and then comes back changed.
I enjoy it. Like, and it's obvious that, you know, now Mycroft was complicit in the fall, as I think many people assumed he was. Because I think everyone at the end of Reichenbach was like, what the fuck did you do, Mycroft? Because you let Moriarty out and made all this happen.
There's just no way he would have done that without a plan.
No.
He's too
and
smart.
And it's totally canon. It works. It's brilliant.
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, yes. And he did get to watch them beat his brother with a pipe for a while. So, you know.
Oh,
well, and can we talk about how that showed that, like, if he chose, Mycroft could be the same thing as Sherlock, but, like, even better at it. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't ever. Like, the only person who can get him to do it is Sherlock, if Sherlock is in danger. Otherwise, he just doesn't care. But he could if he wanted.
Yeah.
He's like an omnibus. He moves on a routine. Like, that was an aspect that I actually was talking about with, of the character before having seen the episode. I was talking with Jen Eaker about this like a couple weeks ago, and how one of the major Mycroft tropes that hadn't showed up in BBC Sherlock, which was kind of surprising to me because Mark Gatiss is such a huge fanboy, is that Mycroft's really lazy. Like, super lazy. Like, he has higher honed powers than Sherlock, but he won't bother using them. He just sort of, you know, has his Diogenes Club and his house and his, you know, like, Whitehall job, and that's it. So it was really cool to see him kind of forced into this, like, secret agent position almost against his will, and then, you know, being super snarky about it afterward, and you're like, yeah, yep, that's you.
Yep, absolutely.
And he's basically like, this is how much I love you, Sherlock. I got out of this chair.
Exactly. All right, from Serbia we go to John visiting 221B to an irate Mrs. Hudson.
I loved angry Mrs. Hudson.
That broke your heart a bit, because he completely dropped the ball on her, which is understandable in the circumstances, but I'm like, oh my god, that's so mean.
It was perfect. It was perfect and terrible. And then he just says, I let everything slide. Like, his whole life. He was like, my life slid. You were part of my life, and I just let everything go.
It's sort of sentimental, the fact that he still, one, has a key to 221B, and two, that Mrs. Hudson hasn't changed the locks. And then when they go actually up into, like, the sitting room, like, nothing's changed. It's all there. And it's just, like, that sort of moment. There's this really beautiful shot of, like, the dust in the light. Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she didn't even dust it because it would have upset Sherlock.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, which is interesting for the canon, because
I was about to say the same thing. Yeah.
Mycroft keeps the rooms going in canon, I think. So I thought it was an interesting thing that they didn't put that in.
Yeah, it was Mrs. Hudson who did it, which I think is fine, because it's her.
Yes,
it was lovely. She's the landlady in this, not the housekeeper. So I guess that makes sense.
I was gonna. Yeah, it totally makes sense, and that's really sweet. I was gonna say the same thing with Amy, which is like, you gotta wonder what Mrs. Hudson from the canon was thinking. It's like, wow, your brother was really devoted to you. Like, there's a shrine to you in my house. That could have creeped me out for a sec.
Yeah. When John is saying that I've met someone, and Mrs. Hudson, bless her soul, assumes it's a guy and is very shocked to find out it is in fact a woman. But it's sort of that fond assumption that Sherlock and John are together. It's always that very fond assumption, which I quite like.
Someone said on Tumblr last night, oh my god, she assumed they were sleeping together the entire time.
She did. She thought they were together. Cute.
It does make me wonder what she thought of all of John's girlfriends, though. Who are you and why are you here?
Maybe Mrs. Hudson's a little kinky.
Are you home wrecking, ma'am?
Yeah, as she says, live and let live.
Mrs. Turner's got married one.
Yeah, it's okay. So
I have to say, though, the mustache was vying for my attention. If I can just bring the elephant back into the room during that whole sequence.
The Morn stash.
The Morn stash. I love how everyone makes fun of the mustache. Poor John and his mustache.
It just looks ridiculous on Martin Freeman. I mean, it's so hot on Jude Law. It's so hot on Jude Law. And on Martin Freeman, you're like, what is on your face?
Please don't ever do this again, please.
I kind of grew fond of it a little bit.
I like it, but, you know, I like mustaches.
I just wanted him in Victorian cosplay, though.
Yeah. Very dashing with the top hat. But then it kind of goes into the big reunion. It was really funny just watching it with people, because you immediately realize what's going to happen. One, John's going to propose to Mary. Two, Sherlock is going to interrupt this proposal. And just watching people, like, just cringing and going, no, please,
don't do it.
not like this.
I felt like I was scolding a puppy. I'm like, no. No, Sherlock. No.
And it has a lovely canonical trope of Sherlock being in disguise when he reveals himself to John again. And it's not, like, the old man at the bookstore, but he does don
a
disguise.
He even did the old man later. I loved that.
Yeah.
But they did. The
I also really liked that he tried so hard to surprise John and was just so baffled that John wouldn't figure it out right away. There's this look he gives the first time when he tells him that he's going to surprise him, and he just doesn't notice. And it's one of the few moments where you get to see Sherlock look confused about something. He's like, why isn't this working?
Element of surprise. Martin Creef came back in a little bit.
Absolutely. Yep. He practically does jazz hands.
Yes, he did. It was basically a jazz hands not dead that we got.
Oh, God, but just the... Because, like, I think immediately you're just, like, feeling for John, because, one, he's obviously nervous trying to propose, and he's trying to get it out, and Mary's, like, trying to help him. She's like, you can do it. And then once
she's
he's
so endearing in that
she's
scene.
So cute. And the moment that John's pretty much, he's going to do it, that's when Sherlock shows the fuck back up. And at the BFI, and I think also last night, that everyone was laughing, and then all of a sudden when John sees Sherlock, the mood switches on a dime. It just goes completely silent, and you're like, oh, shit.
And I have a lot of Martin Freeman feelings, but wow. Just wow. All the awards. I mean, I have wondered how that was going to play out for 2 years, the same as everyone else, and it's like, that was so perfect and satisfying and understated and not overblown and like just Martin Freeman. Jesus. Slow clap. Slow clap it out.
Because he does that thing with his voice when like he can't speak, like he gets choked up on his words, and he did that in Hounds. And
that was painful in Hounds too.
Yeah. And it's like, oh God. And this is something that, you know, Catherine was saying earlier, is that a lot of people are complaining, like, why wasn't it more emotional? I'm like, because they're British.
Well, that, and because he's a soldier. Like, he lost a lot of people. Yeah. This is a guy who doesn't show things like that. Like, that is not the way he expresses himself.
No, well, and he's
like
never.
Nicholas Briggs said the other day, though, there was so much, like, pent-up emotion there that it's almost more effective on screen when people are kind of repressing it. Like, because it's just so hard to watch that.
Yeah, to see him struggling to try and convey something, I think it's much more effective than him all of a sudden going, wah, wah, wah.
Yeah. Well, and Cumberbatch often is so flamboyant, like, and you can see, and they work so well together, because often when he's flamboyant, Freeman is extremely understated. So, and the other way around as well. So, like in the Baskerville episode. So, you know, you have this reaction that is so gut-wrenching and so, like, felt by Martin Freeman, and then Cumberbatch, you see this horrified look in his eyes, like, wait.
The moment he immediately regrets his decision to do this, he's like, oh, this is not a good choice.
But not
good. Well, and I love Mary's line there, because she says, do you know what you put him through? Which is such a great... done? Yeah, because it's like, we haven't seen John, so, I mean, we can kind of imagine what he's gone through, but I felt like that was so, one line was so revelatory of what has happened and revelatory of her character and her priorities as well.
And Amanda Abington has said it too. I mean, like in interviews and stuff, like Sherlock and Mary have a lot in common. They both love John Watson. So, yeah. I mean, it's, right. And that's beautiful. I think that's a great remark that she made in, I forget what interview it was, but they're very much in cahoots almost from the first day she meets him. Which was cool, I thought. Like, fantastic.
Well, and it's like, she knows how strong that relationship has been, which I think feeds in later, which we're not there yet, but to why she's even committed to helping that relationship repair, which I thought was really cool and really interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Going off of John's reaction, I like the fact that we were all gunning for a punch, and instead what we got was assault and battery 3 times.
We absolutely did.
And the beautiful progression of as they got kicked out of each restaurant, the next one they went to was slightly worse.
Yeah.
That was hysterical.
I just, as a Scottish person, the headbutt is the weapon of choice. I was very pleased.
Oh, good.
And this is something that I wanted to sort of touch on upon later, but also it's relevant now, that Sherlock has been on his own for 2 years. He has completely emotionally regressed. So he's inappropriate, and like the fact that he keeps making fun of the mustache when John is obviously like killing himself over what's going on, trying to like realize what's actually, you know, Sherlock is back, he's not dead, and Sherlock just makes these quips and he's like, you know what, fuck you, and that's why he keeps getting, you know, punched harder and harder.
There was a really interesting observation I saw last night about that, and it's like, for John, Sherlock has been dead for 2 years, and he's grieved, and he's mourned, as he even says to Sherlock, like, you know, I mourned you, and I moved on. And then for Sherlock, it's really obvious a little bit later, and we can talk about it later, but, like, just to touch on that for a second, John's been in Sherlock's head the whole time. Like, he talks to John when he's not there. That's already established. Like, John doesn't have to be there for Sherlock to talk to him. And so John is just lives in his head, and so he's just like, I'm back, hi.
John's like, just hanging out in the Mind Palace.
For people saying that Sherlock is so horrible, which he totally is in this episode in some ways, there is the fact that he could have left at any point in that, and, you know, he didn't. He let himself go through this progression and, you know, let John sort of work out his feelings. I think there's something to be said for that, however inept he was at the reunion.
Yes.
He did a better job at it than, well, I'm not going to say a better job. It's about 50-50 between him and canon Sherlock Holmes. Let's throw that out there for a second.
Yeah.
Canon Sherlock Holmes is like, I'm a bookseller, not dead. Woo. Oh,
and then
sorry.
That's basically it,
you're
too.
You're on the floor. I have, I owe you apologies. I'm not going to actually say I apologize, but I owe you 1,000 apologies.
Yeah, and then basically they're like, let's not talk about this ever again.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like having a headcanon where he beats him up, because I kind of want to put that in real canon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the reunion was the empty hearts. I have issues with that story in general, which I think will become a running theme when we talk about this episode and what they chose to include and not include. But yeah, the reunion in the canon, it's just like, no. Because he accepts it way too much, so I like the fact that John is angry. He's angry, and so he's deciding to leave. And I just want to touch upon Mary being like, I'll talk him round. But then we have the deducing of Mary very quickly, but of course Tumblr has now freeze-framed everything and written down.
Oh, God, so everything. Much going on there.
There's so much going on, like things from like, oh, she likes cats and she's a Lib Dem.
And she makes her own bread.
Only child. But something that has come up quite a lot, and we got quite a few questions about from My Giant Robot on Twitter and Elizabeth Stucker on Tumblr. Let's talk about how Sherlock deduces that Mary is a liar. Because that pops up quite a bit in the deduction.
It does, and he doesn't seem worried about it, which is interesting.
I imagine I think at that point he's probably more concerned about the blood flowing from his nose. But yeah, deducing Mary, because there's, first off, I completely adore her. I imagine there is something underneath that, though, very much so, in which we'll talk about later when she gets the text and everything. But yeah,
the liar thing was really great world building. The way it was kind of like that throwaway they did in Study in Pink, where you know you just hear the name Moriarty and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We're not going to give you any more. It's not time.
They're planting the seeds. But let's talk about the Holmes brothers, because just the character development between Mycroft and Sherlock in this episode was phenomenal.
It definitely expanded upon that scene in the hospital and Scandal.
God, I love that so much. I have mad Mycroft feelings, and like it was like so unexpected to me, and it shouldn't have been, but I had completely, you know, I've been thinking so much about the reunion, and I've been thinking so much about Mary Morstan, and I've been thinking so much about all these other things that everybody's really anticipating that I've entirely forgotten. I'm like, oh my God, there's going to be more, you know, Holmes Brothers stuff going on. And it was fantastic. And he, you know, he says, brother mine, and I just melt.
And it does make you worry a little bit about Mycroft's emotional development, that Sherlock Holmes has to be the one to tell him he needs to make friends.
I know. Mm-hmm. He needs a goldfish.
Well, but contrasting that with their scene in the previous series is interesting to me, where in the previous series they're both standing and talking about how they are different from everyone else. Mm-hmm. And at this point we have a Sherlock who's developed enough to say, okay, maybe we're different from everyone else, but I've realized something about people that you haven't realized yet, which I think is a really fascinating thing.
Yeah.
That's definitely John's influence going on there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, like, you have this suspicion throughout the canon that, like, Mycroft is not, he doesn't seem like an unhappy person. He seems like a very, you know, just a bohemian, eccentric, confirmed bachelor, I guess, without any overtones attached to that, in the Victorian style, you know? But he is probably very emotionally isolated, if we were to look at it from modern standards. And maybe we just don't know enough about him, because he's only really in two cases. But it was such a cool thing that they had that conversation. Like, I really, really, really enjoy that, you know, Anthea's back. Or not Anthea, as the case may be.
No, she's actually been named Anthea. We asked Mark after the BFI, and she's actually canonically now known as Anthea.
Oh, she is Anthea.
Yes.
Okay. Good. Glad to know.
And the whole operation thing was adorable.
Might add. Oh, God.
And the whole can't handle a broken heart thing makes you really wonder if there's a backstory to that, or if that's just one of his stabs
at it. Yeah, absolutely.
Is there something that went on? Are we going to find out?
Yeah. I know there are lots of my straw chippers who are just sort of clawing at their faces during this entire scene.
Some literally.
Not that they ever have a conversation in the episode, but...
Doesn't matter.
It does.
When they're... The deduction of the hat, which I think...
Oh, God. Henry Baker's hat.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Such a good, good canonical, like, plug, and also just a great moment, because you talked about the isolated thing, and that's something that Sherlock says. It's like, so what? He's different. It doesn't matter. And mm-hmm. Mycroft doesn't get it. And then Sherlock's like, if he's isolated, that's a bad thing. It's like, yeah. Like, yes, I have friends. You know what? I fake died for those friends. You should get some friends.
It's almost like, it's like Moriarty really taught him something.
Yeah. You know? Because...
And that's actually really beautiful. I love the Henry Baker's hat thing. And it was a perfect combination of the pissing contest they have in Greek Interpreter for entirely for Watson's benefit, by the way. That mm-hmm. pissing contest is like just, oh, look, John Watson's here. Won't this be fun? Like, this will be a cool little tete-a-tete. But it was an exact, like, dovetailing of that with Henry Baker's hat. And it was like, oh, God, I love you, so Mark beautiful. Gatiss.
Yeah, he wrote himself some great moments, I'm just saying.
He did.
Hello, guys! I made it! Hooray!
You made it. All right, we just finished talking about the deduce-off between Mycroft and Sherlock.
That's my favorite bit in the whole episode.
Oh, is it really?
It is. It's very good. It's the bit that I had the chat about Mark Gatiss to about at the BFI.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to expound upon that?
Yeah, well, I went up to him and I said, I just wanted to have a chat. And he was kind of like, oh, yes, and put his drink down and was like, yes, let's discuss things. And I said to him, I really liked it because one of the things about that scene is Sherlock is attempting to show Mycroft that he knows more about something than him, which is that, you know, he can be weird, but he can still have friends. Like, it's better to not to be isolated is kind of the point that he's making. And he does it very cleverly by kind of doing these, like, you know, deductions and things. And the whole, like, line at the end of it, like, how would you know, is like a direct parallel to A Scandal in Belgravia, mm-hmm. when obviously, like, mm-hmm. Mycroft is making fun of Sherlock. And in this one, obviously, Sherlock is making fun of Mycroft, but also trying to get a point across to him saying, you know, it doesn't matter that you're, you know, clever than all the goldfish. Maybe you should have a goldfish of your own, you know, to not be so isolated.
Yeah, exactly that. It was killer. Absolutely killer.
Good.
And I think he's trying to make the impression on him as well that they aren't the only two people in the world, because they kind of, you know, indicated that as children they were the only two people in the world.
Yeah.
Yes. They seemed to think
And then there
were
other children, and what a horrible interlude that was when there were other children.
I was just going to say, if someone doesn't draw me John Watson as a goldfish in a jumper, I'm leaving, like, the planet.
All right, backtracking a little bit, just because we accidentally skipped it, which is a heinous crime, the different reunions that Sherlock had with people, because Molly obviously knew that he was alive, so she's like, oh, shit, mm-hmm. you're back. But I think my favorite one was Lestrade.
Oh, my God, that was so funny.
It was so good. So good. Because
that was the first time I squealed, like I'd been really contained up until then, and when I saw him creeping along behind the strad, I was like,
because I think it lended itself so well to Lestrade being like the pseudo father figure, or like big, like almost a bigger brother than Mycroft was to him in a way, you know, because he immediately is like, I just love that fact that he's like holding that cigarette for ages, like, you utter bastard.
He's so resigned. Yeah. Just like, you would.
But then he hugs him. The hug. Ah.
The best thing about that hug. Yeah, the best thing about the hug was the absolute look of total awkwardness on Sherlock's face. He's like, yes. I am accepting that this is happening, but I refuse to enjoy it.
He refuses to enjoy it for like 90% of it, and then there's this tiny little quirked smile like, okay, I'm all right.
I'm okay now.
Well, what I love about it is that we have Lestrade way back saying that, you know, the whole line about Sherlock is good could be great kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I feel like it's a thing where I did write fan fiction last night, I assume. I mean, I admit, because I am that person. But the fact that it's like so by faking his death for his friends, Sherlock becomes great, but he's actually not dead, so he's back and he's great now. And that's how I like my headcanon goes with Lestrade, is that Sherlock has become the great person that Lestrade was hoping he would be.
Yeah,
I have always thought that that was a really beautiful friendship throughout the books, and it is really cool to see it just, you know, sort of unfolding in the modern setting and wondering what their backstory is, which we talked about on, like, Lestrade appreciation episode of, like, epic proportions. But but this is just, like, he's so glad that Sherlock Holmes exists again, you know?
Yes.
It's super nice.
Super lovely. And then I really thought that Mrs. Hudson was going to smack Sherlock with the frying pan.
She
kind of wish she had.
Yes.
I was waiting for that.
Holmes is completely, in the canon, he's completely sanguine about just saying, like, yeah, I went and threw Mrs. Hudson into violent hysterics. And you're like, really?
Which he did. That's okay. He literally did it just like that. And this. He's just like, all right, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But she's so happy in the end, so it's okay.
It's the scene where she walks in on Mycroft and Sherlock having their little game of operations. She's just so happy with herself, and she, like, kind of gets back Mycroft by doing that wonderful little impression of him.
Yeah.
So great.
That was so cute. That is totally the Mrs. Hudson who, like, crept up on hands and knees to change the position of the wax bust, like, 8 million times.
Yes.
Jeez.
Alrighty. The Empty Hearse, where the episode gets its title, is Anderson's sort of, like, conspiracy theory club, which I quite enjoyed. It's pretty much a fan club, and it opens with another fake theory, which I knew would immediately be the first GIF on Tumblr, and it was.
That's the first GIF that I saw, definitely, on my dashboard, was the leaning in moment. And then I think somebody has now gone on to make it into Lady and the Tramp, with them, like, having,
pasta.
Like, yeah, it's so funny.
It's wonderful. That's so funny.
I'll
reblog.
That's my new favorite GIF.
Send me that right now.
1 second, I can probably reblog it while I'm talking.
About 10 seconds after Reichenbach Fall finished, I was like, I have to write it actually being Sherlock and Jim all along. They had a plan. And then I never did. But they did it for me. And I was just so happy. I was just like, that noise exactly.
Only dogs could hear it.
It made me laugh. I think that was the thing. It was just, like, you knew exactly what they were doing by putting it in.
Yeah. And, like, there's been some backlash of people thinking that Mark was taking the piss out of fans. But I personally think it was all done very lovingly. Because, like, it ends up being, like, a young woman's just sort of, like, her theory. And she's kind of like, no, maybe they just kind of got it on. I don't know. I thought it was doing quite lovely. There's, like, when I first did, like, my little, like, here are some bullet points about, like, what this episode is like. I said it was a love letter to the fans, because there is a lot of fandom inclusion. Like, at the beginning, Anderson says, I believe in Sherlock Holmes, which is an obvious nod to the fan movement. And
I think the fandom scene was the scene that I was sort of most weary about, because we definitely saw a clip of it way back when the trailer came out, and I thought, oh dear, you know, how is that going to be handled? But the beautiful part of it is that she's actually making fun of Anderson. Like, he's obviously like a Sherlock Molly shipper.
Yeah.
And, like, she has her own idea, and she's, like, making fun of him. And to me, like, it was funnier because he was the one who was getting, like, upset, and she was like, well, that's my theory, you know, and I'm happy with it, you know, and she wasn't, like, bothered. It's just, I thought that was quite good. She, like, was, you know, just wanted to put her point across, and he was, like, getting all like, oh, but my, you know, theory. And it just is a very, like, kind of funny reflection of what some people in the fandom are a bit like sometimes. But
I
still
hilarious. Last night, in a bit of a conversation that Catherine and I were having, people were complaining, saying things like that they're pandering to the fans, and
so what? Yeah,
the big thing for me is that they're basing this piece off of a canonical story that was written specifically as a pander. Like, Sherlock was friggin' dead.
Yeah.
And the fans are like, no, we don't like this. And finally, Doyle's like, all right.
Yeah, that
so
and
I was
a,
like,
and
I
a
need
hefty
a sweet,
check.
Sweet cheddar.
Yeah, that and some money. We're fine.
And so I particularly liked that, like, after the first series came out, everyone rushed to get a jumper like John's, and nobody managed to get one quite like John's. And I just love that Anderson's wearing a John jumper, but not quite. Like, he's tried to get his own. And it hasn't quite... He's just gone, oh, that's quite like it. That'll do.
Yeah, the fan reaction last night was really interesting to me, like, in a couple ways, because, like, so the BBC Sherlock fandom, I just want to say, in a lot of ways, is an extremely vocal fandom in the sense that, like, we demand a lot of attention from the show writers, like, as fans. And I think that, you know, things like the Believe in Sherlock, you know, whole meme that was hugely embraced by the fandom, etc., like, that's not the sort of thing that gets sent to Guy Ritchie and Lionel Wigram for whatever reason, you know? And so it's a fandom that actually, it kind of jumps up and down for a lot of attention from the show creators. And it was interesting to me last night when the attention was then given by the show creators, and some of the fans were like, well, we didn't ask for this. And it's like, well, maybe you specifically didn't ask for it, but the fandom as a whole kind of did. And it harks back in my mind exactly the way you were saying to the Conan Doyle era, because, you know, every moment that Conan Doyle is writing Sherlock Holmes being self-aware of the fact he's in the Strand magazine is fan bandering. Like, every second that Conan Doyle is saying Sherlock Holmes is walking around going, oh, God, you wrote another Strand story. Whatever. I guess I'm more famous now. You know? Like, all of that, like, this story you were about to hear is true, that element, it nods to the fans every single time that he knows he's in the Strand, and he knows he's this, you know, kind of like cult figure that John Watson's biographies have turned him into. So this is really not, it's not as meta as everybody thinks it is, or at least it is meta, but it's been going on for a really, really long time. And it's always been embedded in the narrative that Holmes is self-aware of his own fans. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, it's like right at the end where he puts the Deerstalker on. Like, I mean, that's like probably the biggest nod to the fact that he knows he has fans within the show, but also on a meta level, like all of the audience watching it at home, you know, on their TVs.
Exactly. So I think that, you know, like objecting to those, you know, fan nods and fan references is kind of, if people don't like it, then of course they have every right not to like it. But it's in the narrative from the books, you know, that he knows he has these fans.
It's like at this point, it's really interesting to me that there's like a presupposition within the show that people who watch it are engaged in the fandom on a certain level. Like, it's not that you can't watch it and enjoy it without that, but like, I was just gonna say, I got an email from a friend last night, and hi Rick, if you're listening to this, I don't think you will be, because he's not really involved in the fandom, and his email was unpacking some of the stuff in the sort of ways that Sherlock didn't do it that we saw. Because he didn't track what we all immediately tracked, that this was kind of an in-joke with fan theories, because he's not involved in the fandom to that level. And he enjoyed the episode, and he thought it was really well done. But I thought that was really interesting, because one of my first things in the email I wrote back was, you know, okay, this is, you know, first off, this is partly not meant to be serious on a certain level, because it's a bunch of fan theories that they were kind of wish fulfilling out there for us. But he was completely seriously going, well, I don't think this would have worked in the first theory, and I don't think this would have worked in the second theory. And I'm like, okay, you know, that's a way to watch it, but kind of this is a meta level that I think casual viewers of Sherlock, or more casual, might not have quite tracked with. Hopefully they'll have a conversation with someone who can kind of unpack that, but it there was a level there where people who are not as into the sort of internet fandom, I think, maybe didn't quite grab what they were doing there.
I think that's a really interesting point, because I was thinking, I'm like, there's so many in fandom jokes to this that it's very obvious that Mark especially obviously read some theories.
I think it's probably important to note at this point that what they actually said at the BFI is that all of that was filmed at the time of the Reichenbach fall. Like, I think a lot of the kind of fan theories that we actually saw happening, and people are kind of saying on Tumblr and on Twitter that, you know, that they must have gone through and read people's theories, but actually, I don't think they did. I think that they actually... obviously there's only so many things that could have happened, and coincidentally, right, some of those theories like did appear in the show, but all of this was filmed before any theories were put on the internet, which in itself is kind of interesting because there are, you know, only so many ways that he could have done it, or 13, as he says.
Yeah. You know what?
Which I have, right. Yeah.
I think you're completely right, because they did say that they filmed, especially I think the Sherlock Moriarty kiss, I think was definitely filmed before.
Yes.
It would have been so expensive to even attempt to do it otherwise.
I wouldn't have thought so, because didn't they call him back to set?
They did it for the fake scene that they shot of Moriarty and Mycroft.
I didn't think they called him on set for just that.
I think they did. Because they didn't shoot anything on top of the rooftop. It was just, I think it was the bungee jump that they shot. Mm. It was all that, that first beginning sequence. They didn't do anything on the rooftop.
Although, to be fair to people who do have those theories, like, you cannot do almost anything with editing skills. So, you know, it is possible that they did pick up on a few fan theories. But, but it's important to, like, know that as well.
Yeah. And just the Empty Hearse group was sort of just, like, a, they're just sort of going, like, oh, yes, we know that there's all these theories and there's all this stuff. And we're sort of just being like, hey, look, it's very meta. It's very, it was a very meta episode.
Much meta.
Yeah, it was
meta. Much meta. Many fans, much meta.
Yes, exactly. But, I mean, like I was saying, if you're going to complain about it, then you might as well complain about all the meta in the canon and then get back to me.
Okay, moving on. So, Molly comes back into the picture, and pretty much Sherlock realizes he needs a new John. So, he enlists Molly Hooper, bless her heart,
to solve crimes with him.
And I thought it was very sweet, because he's obviously thought that she's capable, which he proves herself to be, because she gets to she does the skeleton and she realizes that it's, you know, only 6 months old. That whole, like, that split sequence between him and Molly, and then John and Mary in the doctor's office, I thought was
adorable.
Yes, adorable, very funny, and also kind of sad in the way that John's life has gotten quite, you know, mundane, which he may be comfortable with, but it is still very different from what he used to have. And then Sherlock, I think there's, like, psychologically, I don't know if, not necessarily having a breakdown, but, like, he's hearing John in his head, and
kind of makes me wonder how long he's been hearing John in his head, you know.
The whole time.
It was kind of, like, disturbing, because, like, at one part you're like, oh, is this an issue? Or is he just, like, realizing that he's doing certain things wrong and that John would be saying something, like it says, like, stop showing off, so he stopped showing off. So, I don't know, it was really interesting, and it just made you realize how, like, completely lost Sherlock is in this situation in London solving crimes again, that he can't do it now without John.
Yeah, I think a lot of... How funny is it that what he hears is, like, John, like, insulting him or saying, don't do that? Like, what? The reason that Molly inherently wouldn't work in the long term is that she's, like, too nice, and, like, she's actually capable of helping, and she's not going to be the one to be like, stop showing off, Sherlock. Like, I just love that that's the things he heard John saying to him, and that's what he feels like he needs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the, like, you know, like, when he says, oh, what is it he says in the first episode? He was like, was that, like, not, oh, yeah, not good. And John's like, yeah, but not good. And that's the kind of the moment that he realizes, he's like, oh, yeah, I need that. That's the reason he needs John, because, you know, sometimes he's a bit not good. Yeah, and John needs to be there to tell him.
Yeah, and then they end up going to the guy with the trains. I like trains.
I like trains.
I like trains.
He really likes trains.
He does. And what's so funny is that all the Londoners are like, that's not the tube map, blah, blah, blah. But the tube map is completely copyright. You are not allowed to use it in anything. So that's why the tube map is not correct in Sherlock.
Oh, well, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it
that's
is under intense copyright.
That's interesting.
Interesting trivia.
Yeah, there you go.
Like, if you even use, you know, the little round station signs, if you even use that, you get in massive trouble.
Yeah, you can get in trouble, yeah. And I think I am in the minority in saying that I really loved the sequence of Sherlock's Mind Palace with all the trains and stuff. Like, I do admit that it went on too long, but I thought it was... I really enjoyed it visually.
I did as well. I think it was a good way for the new director to kind of link up his style with the old style of Sherlock. It's kind of like he is slowly introducing us to, I guess, like a darker, kind of more like edgier style with, like, you know, just kind of experimenting with these things and seeing if they work for him. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, like, we'll see, like, in the next episodes, you know, that more of his style coming through. And like, you know, changing Sherlock as it goes on, like, in a good way. I think I really enjoyed the directing style of it, so it was just one of those kind of experimental things he was trying out, seeing how it would work.
I thought it was very pretty, but if I have one problem with this episode, and I do have one problem with this episode, you know, other than
one
minor
single
quibbles,
problem
if I have one single problem, exactly, it's that I think that, you know, there's all these great moments of, like, you know, Sherlock and Molly solving crime, and there's all these awesome moments that are to do with, you know, just the character arc and the return and the fall and et cetera. But, like, I really think that the train plot with the terrorist scheme is pretty thin on the ground. Like, it's not the strongest plot that they have come up with. And there's so much to do in that episode that I get it, you know? But, like, literally the only clue... the entire time is the train thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't like the train sequence, which is why she says she thinks she's in the minority. I really hated it. I felt like it was watching a bad 1990s music video. It looked and felt to me like something that I would cut together in iMovie and be like, okay. I don't know. I just didn't like it. I think it wouldn't have bothered me as much.
I liked the whole Guy Fawkes through line in the whole episode. Like, the whole Guy Fawkes through line, I just liked it because it was that. I'm not going to argue that it was the most brilliantly plotted thing, but I liked the through line that we had the bonfire.
I liked that it was Guy Fawkes too, but that's it. Like, it's the 5th of November. That's all they give us. It's like, it's the 5th of November and there's a terror thing. And you're like, okay,
so
train.
So are you saying they did what Conan Doyle did in The Final Problem?
Yes. Yes, I am.
One of the weakest stories.
Yes, I am. I mean, they kind of just... I mean, it's
but
not that bad.
But on the plus side, the case part of the story doesn't overshadow the character development.
Yeah, that's,
because
that's,
of that.
Yeah, that's what I want to say. I think I agree that the plot was thin, but I think it was intentionally so. Because I think the primary objective of this episode was Sherlock and John's relationship and exploring how they came back together. And the plot was always going to be secondary to that. Liar, liar, John's on fire.
How dare you?
Check your bonfires for hedgehogs, people. Come on.
And I think this is another part where Jeremy Lovering is the director on this episode, and I think this is in the part where he had a very distinctive style that showed that it's very jerky and sort of, like, fast, and I think that came through the entire episode, but especially in the sequence where John's in the bonfire, and you can't tell where he is for the longest time until you see that little girl looking at the bonfire, and then you're like, oh my god, why? Mm-hmm.
It was probably one of the most dramatic things in the whole episode. I mean, I, like, when we were watching it, I had, like genuine, like, heart palpitations. Yeah. And there were some people in the audience who, like, genuinely thought that, like, John was in real danger, that this might actually be the end for him, and it might, you know, turn into, like, the Sherlock and Mary show. but that, you know, there was, like, a bit of genuine fear that I, like, felt from other people. And even when we rewatched it yesterday, I remember, like, Doodle said she was, had, like, genuine fear over what was going to happen to John. And I think part of that is to do with the directing, the sort of the style of it, as well as, like, what happened.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that directing. It lends itself very well to action sequences.
It does.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, seeing it was even scarier for me, I think, because I recognised the guy who was playing the dad at the bonfire that lit the bonfire. Like, I've got him on Facebook and stuff. I've met him. And I was just like, oh my god, what if Rick, like, sets fire to John Watson? How am I meant to feel about this?
Well, he does set John Watson on fire. You know, because everyone's like, Sherlock Holmes doesn't really eat, so he's having chips, and you know shit's about to get real because he drops his chips. But this is something to go back to Mary, because it's Mary who gets the text that John's in danger.
Mary's in something deep.
Yes, because it's not, I think all of it is targeted at her. And it's getting to her through other people, because everyone assumes that whoever did this is hurting John to get to Sherlock. I think it's completely wrong. I think it's to get to Mary. like, she recognizes it as a skip code, and I'm like, is that, does that mean she's clever? Does she know it's a skip code? Like, Catherine, you said you knew it was a skip code.
Yeah, I mean, I could have worked that out quite easily because I, like, I used to look at, me and my friends used to send each other codes because we're, like, huge nerds. so, like, I recognize certain types of codes. And
is it
there
the same
is a little
one
bit
from Gloria Scott?
It might be.
Is it every third word?
It's every third word,
yeah. It's every third word.
I mean, the other way to recognize it is it's the Victor or Trevor Sr. code.
But what the one thing that I was going to add, actually, and this is just something that's just occurred to me, maybe that's not the first text that she's had from this person, which is why she knew, like, what it was a code.
And she also didn't, honestly, she seemed like she was confused, like she didn't know what was happening to John, but she didn't seem that confused to get an anonymous random code text message. She's just like, oh, this again, almost.
Exactly. So that there is an element of that. So we could make a couple of predictions and see like what happens in the next 2 weeks, you know.
Right. And while we're on the fire, let us remember that fire really shows our priorities.
Yes.
Doesn't it?
As Sherlock barehanded rips fire off of John.
I know, he goes in with his bare hands and rips John Watson from the bonfire.
I'm sorry, I go back to the code for 2 seconds? Because it says John or James, which is totally like a canon
That's
reference.
Great. Oh, God.
It is. It's so funny.
Arthur Continuity Doyle doesn't even know the name of one of his protagonists.
Arthur, that's what the C stands for, continuity.
Just the idea of like Sherlock just screaming John's name, because I think this is obviously the turning point, because right after John comes back to 221B. And so it's the moment.
He was on his way, though. I thought that was sweet. He was on his way there.
He was on his way there before he got, you know, injected.
Yeah. So, you know, he had intentions of mending fences and, you know, like all that stuff. But yeah, that's definitely a massive turning point. And
so, this just a really lovely part that when we get back to 221B, there are two older people there. And they're Sherlock's parents. Yay. And they're also Benedict's parents. Yay!
Yay!
Which I thought was just so sweet. So sweet.
Is it Wanda Ventham and Timothy Carlton? Is
it
that
is.
Their name?
Yes, indeed.
So sweet.
I just adore Sherlock, like, hustling out of the flat, like, don't embarrass me in front of my friends. God, Mom, Dad.
Oh, sorry. Somebody pointed out on Tumblr that his mom has her coat collar turned up.
Yeah, and there's Sherlock gets his coat flipped from his mom.
From his mom. Canon. Yeah. It is so.
And also his beautiful eyes.
Yes.
And the cheekbones are from Dad, so we got it all.
Yep. No, it was really a fun anecdote from the BFI that Benedict said that when he was watching it, he got a bit teary-eyed because he was just so proud of his parents. Because, like, I mean, obviously they're both actors, but just acting with them, I'm sure, is a very humbling and lovely experience.
Yeah, it was very sweet because everybody was so happy, like, and, like, the reaction from the audience was very, like, people were, like, really pleased to see them. And I think that's why he, excuse me, like, was getting quite emotional about it, which is nice, really, because people did recognize them. Yeah. And they were just so there. I think it was Mark Gatiss who said that, like, he, like, really liked the idea of Sherlock and Mycroft having, like, really normal parents. But, I mean, they're, like, normal to a certain extent, but they named their kids, like, Mycroft and Sherlock, like. So they can't
There's
be that
something
normal.
Going on there. I was just imagining the Christmas dinners. I was like, oh, God. Now I know. Now I know something more about what this must have looked like when you talked about imagine the Christmas dinners in the very first episode.
I mean, because there's always that thing kind of hanging over us as well, that like something that Sherlock deduced about the family that kind of like hurt the family quite a bit, but they may never reveal what it is. Like, I think they know what it is that he did, and like a lot of people have like theories, but there's that just kind of that little hint of something like that he did that disturbed their kind of perfect idyllic lifestyle, but like we may never find out what it is.
Yep. Always holding something back.
It's killer, and it, you know, it leaves people so much room to draw and color outside the lines as well. And I love the line as they're leaving where, you know, they're saying, well, we worry, so you need to call more. And it just reminded me of Mycroft in the first episode again. I worry about him constantly. And you're like, you would. Your family would worry about you if you were Sherlock Bloody Holmes, and I risk my life to prove I'm clever.
Yeah.
There's so many angsty fanfic theories about their family and people being dead and everything. And it turns out that his parents are just kind of nice, ordinary sort of people.
I like that, though, because I think there was that sort of assumption that they'd be, like, this super rich, posh family. And, like, I enjoyed the headcanons of, like, you know, Meryl Streep or, like, Helen Mirren being, like, Mummy Holmes. But I did like the fact that they were just normal people who just had extraordinary children.
I think one of the other things that I really liked as well was the hint of what sort of getting us to understand a bit more about Sherlock was the discussion again between him and Mycroft when they're doing the hat deductions about, you know, how Sherlock grew up thinking that he was stupid because Mycroft was so clever, and it was only after they met other people that he realized that he wasn't. And he's kind of spent his whole life with that still kind of hanging over him, like that the sort of initial like childhood thing of thinking he was an idiot, and now that he knows he's clever, he wants everybody else must know it as well to kind of prove to Mycroft, maybe, you know, somewhere deep in his subconscious mind,
it definitely explains the showing off.
So John comes back to 221B, and like, and I think they have like a moment, they're kind of like, oh, what do we do? But then John sits in his chair again, and it's like everything just like went back to normal. Like, or they fell into like the pattern again that Sherlock's like, okay, this is what's happening. Can you help me? And John immediately is like, okay, let's do this. And
it's like their old selves, but I feel like there's this quantum shift in Sherlock's attitude toward people, which I loved, which was like when he was working with Molly, and we didn't mention it, but they hark to A Case of Identity with Mary Sutherland. And she's sitting there, explaining, like, okay, I have this relationship with this internet boyfriend, and Sherlock is sitting there actually with his hand on hers, like, okay,
yes,
and like really
yes,
listening.
Yes.
And it's so much more the Sherlock Holmes in my head, you know, like the Sherlock Holmes of the books, where it's like, this is a guy who can really empathize with people. And he's sitting there, and he turns around, and you know, he does the deductions, and you know, I don't remember if they actually say it's Hosmer Angel, but they say it's the stepfather. That is carrying on this relationship with her, and he's so much more vividly concerned. And I thought the same thread carried over into that scene with Sherlock and John, where like, I'm sorry, after the blind, at any point in the blind banker, I don't think Sherlock asked how the head injury was going. And like, and in this episode, he's like, are you okay? Like, how do you feel? And John's like, smoked. And he makes this, Sherlock makes this face like, yeah, I didn't mean for that to happen, you know? And it just, it seems like he's really gone through so much more, you know, like hardship, and has learned so much about himself, like during these last 2 years, that he's really able to communicate with people on this other level than he did previously. And I thought that was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a lot of the character development is quite subtle, and I think a lot of people did miss some of it because it is quite subtle.
Yeah. It seems like it goes in and out. Cause like, I mean, obviously when we talk about the ending scene, there's, but I think you're completely right. That like really struck me when like he's talking to Molly, being like, "This is what happens," and then he goes back to like yell at the guy, like, "You're a complete piss pot." But it's always that he does feel genuinely bad for this woman, as in like in the episodes previous. Then he's just kind of like, "Bleh, move on, keep going." There's been a switch, and maybe I don't know if that's
a big one.
Yeah, and maybe it's coming back and realizing that he messed up and his reuniting with John, that maybe he's trying harder. So when John is back, then he's like, I need to try harder, which I think does go. And then he kind of fucks up at the end, but in a okay.
I was going to say, that goes for, he tries harder to a point.
I don't know. I have my own.
Me too.
Me and Mad Lori have similar opinions on that.
Oh no, I completely scene, agree. I completely we'll agree with Lori. But yeah, we will talk extensively about that. Yes. John's back in 221B, and then we are introduced to Lord Moran of the Realm. Duh.
That was the thinnest John character. Seriously.
did we get the Rat of Sumatra reference that was coming through there? He was
Sumatra Road.
And the rat has come out of his den.
The rat has come out of his den. Yeah, that was lovely.
Yeah, the giant rat.
So that's where the rat came from.
I really wish there had been more done with that character, though.
Yeah, really, any kind of world building would have been nice there.
Yeah, and, like, if he had been, like, that final key to, like, dismantling Moriarty's, you know, stranglehold over Sherlock Holmes's life and over London and over, you know, his criminal organization, I just felt like it would have added a certain layer to it. And, like, I get that you have only time for so much stuff, but, like, honestly, BBC Sherlock has given us, like, three pretty awesome villains. The cabbie in the first one is pretty badass. Mm-hmm. Like, he's interesting. He's an interesting guy. You've got Jim Moriarty, who Andrew Scott's Jim Moriarty is, like, just astoundingly good. And then I think you've got Laura Pulver as Irene Adler. And for the rest of the baddies, I'm not really that compelled by any of them. And I mean, let's just leave the blind banker out of it, as we generally do. But because that arch nemesis was really not, let's not, you know, do that trope Fu Manchu any longer. But the, Chappie in Baskerville, he's okay. But then I really expected a lot from Moran, and I just felt like I didn't get it. So I'm just going to leave that there, yeah, and you guys talk, yeah, about it.
I almost feel like they wasted the character name almost. Yes. It's like they slapped a character name on a insignificant person when they probably should have kept that back and used it at some point, to me.
Having Mycroft tell Sherlock, you need to, you know, this is happening to London, you need to find this, that I felt like that would have been a great canon reference opportunity to have the Moran line go all the way through, like Lindsay was saying, and have that be kind of the last piece of the puzzle. But he's, you know, half the plot being more or less the same, but have that link be there to who Moran actually is. Because that would have, to me, given such a strong reason for Sherlock to go back to London, even stronger than we had in the episode. I'm just basically agreeing with Lindsay that I felt like, I didn't hate it, but I felt like there was a lot more potential there for that character and for what he represents. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm guessing and wondering if they didn't do it because they knew people would expect them to do it, but I felt like for an episode that had so many canonical references, it really wouldn't have taken much more time to establish that.
You wait all these years for them to put your favorite in, and then he's hardly in it.
And I imagine, Catherine, you're about to say what I'm going to say, is that there was a question asked of Mark Gatiss about this at the BFI Q&A. And
I was actually going to expand on that. So I was going to expand on it.
Yeah, it was just that Mark felt that Moran wasn't a very good villain. And so he felt that he wanted to concentrate more on Sherlock and John rather than Moran. So he wanted to have an ode to Moran, but not have him as the main villain.
I think that was a mistake. Yeah.
It almost as if they disregarded him as well, because Mark Gatiss was kind of like, not to kind of paint him in a bad light, but he was saying, you know, he's just a henchman. Like, kind of that was like his opinion of him. He doesn't really, he's not that important. But I think one of the things that just going to make Turk even more angry. But one of the things that I was thinking as I was kind of like trying to get in time to like be on the podcast was that the interesting thing that the fandom has done is that they've created like a parallel. So we've got, you know, the good guys, which is Sherlock and John together as a partnership, and like what's really nice is that people have created then this like parallel relationship where you've got Moriarty and his henchman Sebastian, who are like the total opposite to John and Sherlock, and that like creates a really interesting like narrative that people have explored, you know, in their own mm-hmm. fictions and things and through art and some fantastic stuff that we've seen online. But then when it didn't happen in the episodes, I think that was quite disappointing for a lot of people, because like you almost wanted to have this like parallel relationship of like almost like straight up good versus evil, you know, but it just didn't happen. Like, it wasn't there, and that was just simply because they didn't think that he was that important.
Yeah,
and you've got those parallels in The Empty House with the, you know, he's an army veteran, you know, he's just an army veteran gone bad. Yeah. Like, it's right there, you know, like this whole,
and it's really interesting
sort of, like,
it almost
mirroring.
Yeah, it almost suggests, like, you know, what if John Watson had met Moriarty instead of Sherlock? You know, what would have happened then?
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah, I feel like, I mean, I guess I see why Gatiss feels the way he does, but I feel like he missed something really big there, character-wise.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's been 2 years, so the fanon versus the canon has become so extreme that...
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of it was build up, and I guess that's just what happens when you have such a long hiatus, that the fans will create, like, as you say, like this parallel world, and then when it doesn't happen, it's like that step back and you have to realize it was always fan made and it wasn't what was actually going to canonically happen as much as you wanted.
Well, for me, I just wanted him to be based on who he is in the books, you know?
Yeah, no, completely.
Yeah, I just wanted to see the canon.
Yeah, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Because I see that
no, you're right,
versus
you're
evil
right.
parallel in the canon, personally. I've never even thought about it so much in the fan and stuff, but I see it in the canon, like you were saying. You've got the army sniper who works to the genius. And
yeah, and I thought at first that they were going to go there because Sherlock and John both say they recognize that face. So I thought they were going mm-hmm. to do something that John knew him, but they didn't, which was a bit sad.
I'm just very grateful for the small mercy that we have a face for him.
Yeah, Moran doesn't even have any lines, really. He just sort of lounges on his hotel bedroom with fabulous hair, I will say.
Hair, yeah. It's probably his strongest character trait.
And something interesting that I saw on Tumblr was that the code is May 11th, 2013. And Mary said that their wedding's going to be in May.
Huh.
So I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I knew somebody would pick up on that, actually, because I was watching to try and figure out what the numbers were, and then I was like, oh, I'm too tired. But someone on the internet will figure it out.
Yeah, and someone did. Yeah, it's... So if they get married on May 11th, and it's like, oh god, everything's connected! Which it probably is. But I just thought that was really interesting. Yeah. The bomb shenanigans. The two... This scene has caused such
anger,
such dire straits.
I know. Oh, man.
I think it's something
so good.
Subtle that people are missing again, but that's just me.
Well, there's pretty much, I think, two arguments. One, that they needed a cover. That Sherlock, and I think this is true, that Sherlock genuinely did not know how to defuse the bomb. Because I think even when they show that when he finds the switch, he is panicking. And then he finds the switch. And he's like, holy shit, okay. Because I think he does not know how to defuse it. And that's why he tells John to go and run. Because
mm-hmm.
he's yep. like, I can't do this. And that he lets John continue to believe that they're going to die because they need a cover that they can have this conversation. That Sherlock mm-hmm. needs to hear that John forgives him, that he needs to hear it, and he figures that the only way that John's going to admit this if he thinks that he has 2 minutes to live. And there's that cover, which I think is the Mad Laurie argument. That's the one big argument. And the other one is that it was just an incredibly dickish move, which it is a dick move, but that Sherlock doesn't have remorse, and people thought I was too out of character considering his development earlier on. So disgusting.
I have something to add on the out of character, though.
Mm-hmm.
This is my theory on the out of character. People are like, you see him this whole episode being nicer, being more sympathetic. The things he says to Molly are wonderful. The way he treats the clients that come in. And then you see him with John, and he's still behaving like this. And I think part of that is he has never viewed John as a normal person like everyone else ever.
Yeah.
He doesn't think that he has to pretend to be empathetic. Mm-hmm. He doesn't feel that he needs to really hide and not do the things that he would normally do to spare John's feelings. Because I don't think he's ever viewed John that way.
I like that. And I also think that... a lot of people forget that they have this really bizarre sense of humor as well, like both of them. You know, like they go into a crime scene and start giggling, you know, and like they, you know, there's like a bomb, you know, there's this very like really like bizarre kind of sense of humor that they both share, and especially Sherlock kind of like maybe takes it too far sometimes. But there's also the sense that I think people have been kind of spoiled a little bit by certain like types of American television, and you kind of have to remember that like the English style of television is a little bit different, which is where some of this might be coming from as well.
English style of emotion is different.
we don't talk about our feelings.
No,
come on.
Talk about weather.
we talk about weather.
They wouldn't as characters. I mean, I absolutely agree with Laurie on this. Like, they wouldn't as two British dudes have that conversation in any other context. And I completely agree with Chris. Like, he has no idea what to do, and they would never have had that conversation if John had obeyed him and left. Like, he says, go, get out. Like, at least you'll get out of this, and I'll try to work this out, you know, however I can. there,
Sherlock needs a good reason
really,
to beg.
I think, genuine panic going on there where the mind palace is not working, and then he leans down, and there's the switch in front of him. And I thought it was so interestingly done, and not, you know, like, maybe to an American sense of... I thought it was maybe not to an American sensibility, and I totally agree with you, Catherine, that, like, that's probably part of it. But, like, this is not a conversation that they have ever face-to-face in the books, and it was so... They lift that gorgeous best and wisest man line straight from the final problem, from the end of the final problem, that just breaks your heart. And you absolutely know that every word John's saying is true, that he truly feels this. And there's this look on Sherlock's face when he looks up at him and after that best and wisest line where he's, I think, genuinely, like, gutted by this. And, like, the fact that it turns into, okay, the bomb element was not... maybe everything that I indicated that it was, I don't think it diminishes a thing. I mean, at least for me, it doesn't, because they would never have had that talk ever.
And also because they are friends, like, they need something to kind of, like, if you, you know, I know this from, like, experience with talking to people, when you have, like, a really highly emotional moment, you kind of need to have something where you're like, okay, we need to, like, just laugh now, like, we need to just, like, not be talking about our emotions and just kind of, like...
There was
which is exactly
what happens in the books almost every time, with one glaring, massive with one huge exception that we all know what it is. Sherlock Holmes always does this. He'll have this moment of, like, I'm going to tenderly shake your hand and say, I knew you would not drink at the last. And then he's like, ha ha ha, let's go rob a house. Or, like, in The Devil's Foot, where it's like, Watson, I am really sorry I almost killed you. It was an unjustifiable experiment for me, doubly so for a friend. Ha ha ha, never mind, we're both crazy. Hilarious. Like, he does
this all the time. There was also, in Sherlock's laughter, there was that edge of the literally hysterical. And I think that leads to what Christina said about how there was a very real thing going on where he didn't know how he was going to stop that bomb. So part of that is the laughter that he's got going on, to me, is a relief, like, oh, okay, I figured this out. We're good. We're not.
Yeah, sort of that, like, oh my God, we almost die. I need to laugh, or I don't know. I don't think Sherlock has emotionally, like, regressed and developed, and he's, like, all very quickly, I feel, in this episode, so that he doesn't know how to deal with it. So it's, like, the laughing and just the being a dick about it, where he could have just let it slide and be like, oh my God, look, I fixed it. And not have, you know, started laughing, but it's a coping mechanism, I think.
And it's right.
I think he has too much curiosity. I felt like there was a really complicated progression there. I agree that at the beginning he's not sure exactly how they're going to get out of it. And then at the moment that he sees the switch to turn it off, I think there's an element of curiosity there. Like, you know, Sherlock Holmes is a scientist of everything, including humans, and I think he's at that point thinking, if I don't tell him that we're out of this, what will he say? And I felt like that was kind of a thing where he couldn't resist finding out what John would say.
Yeah, I like that too.
That's a good point. Yeah,
it's all very it's intense, and I completely do understand why some people will feel that it's super dickish, because the first time watching this at the BFI, I actually said out loud, Sherlock, you dick, when he started laughing in front of, like, you know, hundreds of people. The second time around, I really looked at it, and, like, I think you're completely right, Lindsay, that at the moment when John says the best and wisest man I ever know, that when Sherlock looks up, there's this different look on his face.
There's nothing fake about that look.
Yeah.
I've been staring at the gift sets, believe me.
Well, it just shows, like, what superb acting they are, because they do say that the best actors are the ones that, you know, actually listen to each other and listen to the lines. And I think that both of them do that. They are very good at listening, and not just listening to the lines, but, like, reading each other's cues and things, like, on their faces. They are very, very good at that. And it's the moment, you know, when, like, Sherlock realizes that, like, he's kind of screwed up a bit when he tries to do the, you know, coming back from the dead. And he's like, oh, I done fucked up. As John, like, shows his emotions, you know.
We get to, it's in the cutscene where we think that, oh God, they've blown up, that Sherlock is explaining to Anderson how he survived. And this, of course, lends itself to the question, and of many that we got from listeners, saying that is what Sherlock tells Anderson the actual truth?
My basic bottom line thought was they're saying this is probably the most plausible, but if you see plot holes in it, we're giving you an out so that you can know that it's not 100% definitely.
Yeah, that was the closest to what I thought it was going to happen, because, like, the moment I saw him fall from that building, I just was reminded of an old episode of Jonathan Creek, where a very similar thing happened, and, like, he jumped from a rooftop, but landed on, like, a trampoline. The kind of the 13 things I think people have misinterpreted a little bit when he said, like, there were 13 possibilities. I think when he said that there were 13 things he thought Moriarty could have done that he needed to get out of, as opposed to 13 ways he could have survived falling off that building.
I disagree. That too.
You disagree with that?
I disagree.
It was 13 ways he could have escaped from Moriarty, and not necessarily all of them being jump off the building, because, you know, he would have to have known absolutely that Moriarty was going to make him kill himself, and he might not have done.
I kind of think you might be right about that, personally, because I feel like it's ways that he could have escaped, not necessarily jumped off the building, simply because when he says it, and when they go into his mind palace and thought process, one of the things he's looking at are fire escapes and ways to jump to other buildings.
True.
Yeah.
Yes.
He and is. He mentions, that's there's true. Another canonical nod that he mentions, like, there's this Japanese fighting style, and then, like, he gets cut off.
Yeah, I know. Which is so ridiculous. It's amazing.
That was great.
Bartitsu. And I think also that it's satisfactory in the fact that, regardless of what the writers came up with, the expectations have been going on for 2 years. The theories have been going on for 2 years. There was no way they could ever do something that was going to universally please people. So what they did was that they kind of left it open-ended.
It's better than I reversed my boots, and it's better than I borrowed Mycroft's inhaler. Like, so
they're far getting... is our best option.
It's the best solution thus far. Oh. And, like, it is completely plausible. And I think, and it was funny, because when he did the ball under the armpit, like, the entire audience was just like, yes! Because, like, obviously everyone knew that. Because they made that very apparent with, like, the playing with the ball.
I always hoped that was also a nod to House MD.
Yes. I was hoping it was a House thing.
It may very well be.
Down. Yeah.
Bless Anderson. Just,
clawing the wall. I still need to know everything that's on that wall. So far, we've narrowed it down to, like, some of the fake news stories, and there's a TARDIS.
There's a TARDIS. God, there's a picture of
so
a TARDIS.
So good.
Well, the actor was my first ever celebrity crush as a child, so I came into the first series with far more Anderson feelings than anybody should have. So to have him there being, like, Sherlock's biggest fan, I'm not entirely sure I can handle that. That's just, like, too cool.
Oh, something, the Lazarus thing. Someone on our Tumblr sent this to us, and...
Lazarus dies, his sisters are hacked off because Jesus doesn't get there in time, and so he dies, and Jesus raises him from the dead, later. So it's like, there's a concept of, like, not getting there on time, but him rising from the dead. So yeah, it was a pretty obvious link up to a miracle where someone is raised from the dead.
I love that conversation they have in the hallway, though.
It is.
Oh, God.
It's very poignant.
I heard you made me want to cry.
I know. Aww.
And there's no threat of death happening at that point. There's no sort of, like, oh, you know, we're under extreme amounts of pressure. This is a very adrenaline-fueled situation. It's just this conversation, and it's like... Yeah.
There's your closure.
And, like, I quite like as well at the end where Sherlock turns to him, you know, and John's trying to get him, and I imagine he'll eventually get on to him about how he did the fall, but he just turns to him and says, you know my methods, John. And I almost feel as if he's also talking to us at that time, like, saying to us, like, we know his methods, now you go away and think what you want of, like, how I did the fall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll do a few questions from listeners. And one that just kind of going off of what we just said is from He Said Dangerous on Twitter. And she asks, did we, or more importantly, John, get the why? Which I don't think we did.
No, not really.
No.
I think at one point that Sherlock will say, I jumped off because they were going to kill you. I really hope that is not sidelined.
Because literally all he says is because Moriarty needed to be stopped.
And then he goes then he's like, oh, ah, that.
And then there's that
And then he makes a joke, and that's when John attacks him again. Because he can't emotionally go there, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't mention when we were talking about the Anderson scene that he filmed that.
Mm-hmm.
Anderson filmed him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in that version, he does mention the snipers.
Yeah, so presumably if this is
being... So it might come back through the film, if nothing else.
You're completely right.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's all in that confession.
A really interesting question from Abby Kate on Twitter. Let's talk about perspective. This is the first time we've seen all of this viewed from Sherlock's point of view. Like, the episode in general, a lot of it was mired from Sherlock's point of view, which is really interesting. And I think that's why we got so many, like, mind palace sequences and, like, that kind of thing.
It's often John's point of view in the other episodes, isn't it? It's true, which, yeah, quite naturally so. But exactly, I mean, John is so just, you know, ticked off at this point that you're in Sherlock's head quite a bit. And it was really revelatory. That was cool. You get so many of the, you know, kind of intimate fraternal moments and, you know, moments with Molly Hooper and all of these, you know, little things that are not based in John Watson trying to understand Sherlock Holmes, but are based in Sherlock Holmes living his life.
Yeah, you get to actually see the character development of Sherlock because you're seeing it from his own head. You're seeing how his thought processes have changed. You're not just seeing the results of that change.
Well, and I think the directing style works really well with that. Arguably, the idea that this is how Sherlock's mind works, this kind of very fast-paced, somewhat jerky kind of style that we had, I think worked really well with that perspective.
Misty Zero on Twitter brought something up that I hadn't thought of. Have any of you listened to the Sherlock Holmes audio dramas that that Benedict read?
Yeah, the train.
Apparently, the conundrum of Coach 13 incredibly mirrors the plot of Empty Hearst. Oh, you know what?
You're right.
Really?
Well, yes. Coach 13, just, you know.
The coach that disappears.
Cool.
I don't know if that was intentional. I'm sure there's an obvious link there. Two obvious links. One, Benedict. And two, you know, Sherlock Holmes. Waysinger Gum asks, did Lestrade know? Which I don't think he did.
I would say not.
No, because
no.
When we talked to Mark said that maybe Lestrade had some idea.
He may have had a thought.
He had maybe in the back of his mind, maybe he thought or he hoped. But that wasn't in on it.
I think he had a hope, not an idea.
And to end on a silly note, from Flawed Amethyst, who wore the facial hair better, Anderson or John?
Anderson.
I have to go with Anderson myself.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm going to have a slightly ginger beard versus tiny moustache. I mean, it's not even a competition.
I'm going to have to stand in the John Watson corner and support the moustache.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I'm with Catherine.
Yeah.
Moustache all the way.
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think Anderson wore it better, but I want a plush doll of John with the moustache, so what can I say?
We'll call it a draw then.
Excellent.
Woot. All right, so yeah, that was episode 49, The Empty Hearse. Episode 50, The Sign of Three, will come out right after that episode.
All too soon.
Stay tuned. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?